Hello and welcome to AMSSM Sports Medcast. As we approach the 2024 AMSSM annual meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, we continue our mini journal club series highlighting each of the top articles in sports and exercise medicine from 2022, as selected from last spring's annual meeting in Phoenix. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Schroeder, Sports and Exercise Medicine at Madigan Army Medical Center in Tacoma, Washington. I am joined today by Dr. Scott Paradise, a member of the Top Articles Subcommittee, which is part of the AMSSM Education Committee. Welcome, Scott.
Hey, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Paradise is a sports and exercise medicine physician in the United States Navy and currently serving as a regimental physician for the 2nd Marine Regiment at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina. He graduated from Penn State University College of Medicine and completed his family medicine residency at AT Augusta Military Medical Center at Fort Belvoir, followed by a fellowship at the Naval Hospital Camp Pendleton in sports and exercise medicine. He currently holds a faculty appointment as assistant professor of family medicine at the Uniformed Services University of Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, and additionally serves as clinical faculty at the Naval Hospital Camp Lejeune Primary Care Sports Medicine Fellowship. Scott, thank you so much for coming on and joining us today.
Yeah, really happy to be here. Thanks.
We recently reviewed articles 11 through 6 with one of your colleagues, Dr. Angela Rufo, and today we enter our top five. We're going to cover two papers today, the first of which is number 5 on our list. Now, this is a systematic review and meta-analysis that's from the February 22 issue of Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery by Drs. Kim, Park, Lee, and Jung, entitled Platelet-Rich Plasma Injection versus Operative Treatment for Lateral Elbow Tendinosis. So to start off with, can you remind us what the difference between a systematic review and a meta-analysis is and what they typically look for?
Yeah, right. So a systematic review generally talks to the systematic approach of collecting records from the literature base and analyzing them in a systematic fashion. There's lots of ways to do this, published by Cochrane and AmSTAR, ways to go through the literature in a step-by-step process to come up with a conclusion to inform practice. We typically think of the systematic review as sort of the qualitative part of that process, where you're looking at each of the studies individually, comparing their conclusions against each other and their results against each other. We think of the meta-analysis when pool all those studies together, you know, in a pairwise meta-analysis, come up with something called a forest plot where you combine all that data and come to a conclusion using basically broadening your total N or your total number of patients that you couldn't just do with one or two studies.
Yeah, I always try to figure out what that is. And a majority of our top articles do come from systematic reviews, trying to increase strength and draw conclusions more fully than perhaps just a standalone randomized controlled trial. Now here, the field of regenerative medicine, and in particular platelet-rich plasma, remains a hot topic with the field of sports and exercise medicine. Lateral elbow tendinopathy, along with knee osteoarthritis, seem to be the most studied overall. Now, this is from the Journal of Shoulder and Elbow Surgery. That was a new addition to the pool of core journals added last year. Previously, this wouldn't have necessarily been on your radar, and now it's in the top five. What made it stand out to you?
Yeah, so, you know, in the search process, we always try to get the core journals fully scrubbed, and then we also look for keywords throughout the literature, and that includes orthobiologics and PRP, stuff that we know is hot in the sports medicine literature and is popular topics for us to look at. So while we didn't include this journal in prior years, you know, hopefully it would have been caught by our sort of keyword search using PRP or orthobiologics or something like that. But to answer your question, you know, lateral elbow tendinopathy is an incredibly frustrating position. It's frustrating for patients, frustrating for clinicians. It lasts a long time, usually it affects patients' dominant hands. And it just can be very debilitating, right? Opening jars is a problem for patients, you know, lifting their fork to their mouth, you know, in some severe cases. So we're always trying to come up with like novel treatments. And because of that, as you mentioned, lateral elbow tendinopathy, in addition to knee OA, has kind of become a poster boy treatment for PRP because it was one of those early signals that we saw in the PRP literature with some of our early double-blind trials that we saw a good signal for PRP's benefit. this study is kind of nice because, you know, we have studies that compare PRP to other treatments, steroid, you know, placebo, dry needling. But this is, we don't have a lot of studies that compare PRP injections to surgical treatments, right? And so that's exactly what Tul Ho Kim, Dr. Kim and his group were thinking when they performed the study. How does PRP compare to our operative treatments in addition to the standard injections or non-interventional treatments that we've been using?
I think that's a great clinical question to start off with and looking to investigate. So now, how do they construct the systematic review and meta-analysis?
So as you mentioned, systematic review and that meta-analysis portion, they're pretty strict in how they form their exclusion criteria. They really only wanted to include trials that looked at PRP and operative treatment. And that excludes like just purely tenotomy, that excludes PRP with tenotomy, that excludes treatments of PRP and other trials. So in doing so, they actually only came up with four trials total that they included in their systematic review, two of them randomized trials and two retrospective cohorts. And in a fairly smaller number of patients that we're typically used to seeing in some of these larger systematic reviews and meta-analyses. We only had 340 patients in this trial total. So definitely on the smaller side of a systematic review.
Now, looking at these four studies and differentiating only about 340 patients in total, now with those in the PRP group, was there any mention or description of what the PRP products that were actually used, whether it be leukocyte poor, leukocyte rich, any differentiation or quantification of volume, platelet concentration, et cetera? Because we know that PRP is not all created equal, and there's a lot of differentiation. That's where a lot of our focus in regenerative medicine research is going into and trying to quantify these things rather than PRP being just one unchanging product.
Right, Jeremy. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head and the difficulty that we face with a lot of these systematic reviews, especially pairwise systematic reviews where we're trying to compare apples and apples. If I'm comparing five different PRP preparations against a placebo or another treatment, you know, am I really comparing the same PRP treatment across all those arms? And the answer usually across literature and prior systematic reviews is no. Out of these four trials, three were leukocyte-rich PRP, and they list the machines, and you can go to the studies individually to figure out, you know, what exact protocols they use. One of the studies included in the trial doesn't actually say whether it's leukocyte-rich PRP or not, so that's a difficulty. And then just beyond that, like, you know, what's the actual makeup of the PRP? Is it ultrasound-guided? Three studies just use landmark injections for their PRP. One uses ultrasound. One uses two injections of PRP. The other three just use one. Even in the surgical arm, most of the studies had similar surgeries, but one surgery was arthroscopic and the others were all open surgeries. So there's a lot of differences in these studies. And even though these may feel like small things, especially when they're combined together and meta-analyzed, they can lead to very meaningfully significant changes in our confidence in the review's conclusions.
It's great to break that down and look at those things because those are critical questions. And when we're reviewing literature, it's important that we do analyze these different things and ask these questions rather than just looking at the conclusions and taking it all at face value. There are different things that we want to look at. So what were some of the key findings that came out of the systematic review between PRP and operative intervention?
Right. So the results in this study were actually pretty straightforward, right? They looked at pain and functional outcomes. They used the PRTEE scale as their primary functional outcome measure. And they found that between those two treatment methods, surgery and PRP, there was no difference pain or function at 2 to 3, 6, or 12 months.
And the PRTEE is patient-related tennis elbow evaluation?
That's right. That's right. You got it.
It usually doesn't make the top list of my functional scale scores, but that's good. It seems to be validated for this intent and purpose, I think. So saw no difference in pain at these different intervals and no difference in function. What are your big take-home points or bottom line from this systematic review?
I think the biggest conclusion is that we don't have a lot of studies in this arena comparing PRP to surgery. And so there's still a lot of work to be done. Even among those four studies, there's as we discussed, quite a good deal of heterogeneity. The other concern we have is the studies included may not actually mirror common or best practices in musculoskeletal medicine. Specifically, you know, when I say that, I'm thinking using ultrasound guidance to place our orthobiologics injections, as kind of discussed in prior position statements and, you know, best practice recommendations. Nonetheless, you know, the lack of difference between these two treatment arms definitely says that if you fail conservative management and you're thinking about the next step, PRP is definitely something to consider prior to going to surgery, especially given the delta in risk and cost associated with those two treatment arms.
And does this move the needle for you at all in your personal practice?
You know, I think it's very confirmatory for me. I never love sending my patients for surgery or debridement for lateral elbow tendinopathy. And I was already on the bandwagon of doing PRP for lateral elbow tendinopathy, just given the prior trial data we discussed at the top of the episode. So in a sense, it's confirmatory. I don't know if it's super practice changing otherwise for me, though.
All right. So now let's move on to top article number 4. This is outcomes of athletes with genetic heart diseases and implantable cardioverter defibrillators who choose to return to play. Now, I'm really excited to discuss this with you. I remember watching Danish midfielder Christian Eriksen collapse on the field during the Euro 2020 tournament. And then it was absolutely amazing that he returned to the field for Brentford only 8 months later. So I think it goes right into this. And this is a retrospective case series by Tobert, Boss et al. In the November 22 issue of Mayo Clinic Proceedings, which isn't necessarily one of your core journals, but was caught up from a keyword, correct?
That's correct, Jeremy. Yep.
Excellent. So can you take us through how this retrospective case series was set up?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, just to kind of emphasize what you said, you know, I think we were all pretty scared when we saw Christian Eriksen and multiple other athletes, whether soccer or other sports, collapse on the field. And then some of them have been able to return at the highest levels after ICDs, which is super promising. I just love the opening text of this article. Implantable cardioverter defibrillators, competitive sports participation have long existed as an oxymoron. And it's like an easy board question, right? What athlete is incredibly likely to have a repeat event? It's an athlete who has had one in the past or has a genetic heart disease and now has an ICD. And so, you know, a large reason that we have like PPEs or pre-participation exams is to find these athletes and say like, hey, maybe I'm not so sure. We need to maybe either adjust your sport or consider like retirement from competitive sports. And this study kind of gives more and more to the building evidence base that we can, in the future or in the long term, start including these athletes more and more in competitive sports at high levels too, and at high dynamic and static exertional components.
I think that's super great. Yeah, I remember in the PPE 5th edition, I can visualize that graph of showing like, hey, what sports may be available for people with genetic heart diseases, such as hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and looking at what they're almost relegated to. And introducing this concept of shared decision making and having opportunities to have those discussions with our athletes, I think is very meaningful. So now, how is this data collected?
As you mentioned, this was a retrospective case series, rather. It was performed at Mayo, and it was under the guidance of a clinician with extensive experience in managing athletes with cardiac conditions, right? They have a large patient population that mirrors the athletes who have genetic heart diseases, undergo extensive risk stratification, extensive counseling on their return to play decisions. And they were able to take that large populations and basically do a chart review and figure out how many of those are having events and how many are safe and how many are not. So that's kind of where all this data came from and the impetus for the study.
So what do they find? How many athletes total? And
they included 125 athletes with genetic heart diseases. And that includes, you know, your long QT syndrome, your HOCM, like you mentioned, catecholaminergic polymorphic VTACs, TPVT for short, and more, who had received an ICD and then returned to play a sport. So they followed them out as long as their records would allow. and basically evaluated if they had, you know, a recurrent event. So their primary outcome was this thing called a breakthrough cardiac event, which they defined as like a symptomatic arrhythmia terminated by the ICD fire or sudden cardiac death.
Okay. And then looking at the amount of these 125 athletes and seeing if they had one of these BCEs, what was discovered, the breakdown retrospectively?
So again, they had that large pool, 125 athletes with an ICD, only 28 of them had a breakthrough cardiac event. So, you know, just under 100 of those athletes, just under 80% did not, right? About half of those 28 were during sport, and the other half weren't related to sports participation, corresponding to about 6 events per 100 athlete years in another way. And that was the same whether it was, you know, HOCM or long QT, CPVT, whatever it was. So similar rates of breakthrough cardiac events across disease states. The important thing, though, no deaths. So even though some of them are having symptomatic arrhythmias or an ICD fire terminating like VTAC or VF, none of them experienced sudden cardiac death, which is really what we worry about in these athletes.
Absolutely. So some pretty astonishing things that out of the 125 athletes with ICDs that have known genetic heart disease, that only 28 of them had a BCE, and half of those were completely unrelated to sport in general. And nice to know that the ICD interventions are effective, resulting in no deaths recorded from this population. So what are your overall take-home points for this review, and how does it help you as a sports and exercise medicine physician in counseling your athletes in the decision-making process?
That's a great question. It's really what we care about when we read these studies. I think the study's great for a few reasons, right? So the first one, it's the longest and largest case series of athletes with one of these genetic heart diseases who have had an ICD and then returned to play afterwards and did well. You know, and then the other thing is it didn't just include like low dynamic and low static exertion. It's not just ping pong or golf people going back to, you know, those are great sports and important sports for people to get back to. But we also have people going back to 2C and 3B sports, you know, your soccers, your basketballs, you know, et cetera, right? And so people are returning to sports, and they're returning to sports that are highly exertional in nature, which is good to know. And then, you know, the other thing that we didn't mention was that, you know, not only are we worried about an athlete experiencing a sudden cardiac death on the field, we're also worried about, you know, we've just put in a pretty expensive piece of hardware into someone's chest with the goal of preventing a fatal arrhythmia. And if my linebacker, my running back gets tackled on the 1 yard line and snaps his ICD in two, you know, is that going to then not be able to stop an arrhythmia or, you know, prevent a sudden cardiac death, you know, 2 weeks later? And they did find some device malfunctions in the study. They found 37 actually device malfunctions, but none of those device malfunctions were related to sports participation. So, you know, just another excellent little piece of data that they found to support returning athletes to competitive sport. There is one big caveat though in this, right? So I don't run a clinic with a lot of experience managing complex genetic heart disease cases, patients with ICDs that I can follow longitudinally, right? And so that's the big generalizability concern that a lot of readers will have with this. The study was at a referral-based subspecialist center. They have years and years of experience risk stratifying patients and kind of talking to them about when it's safe to return to sports. And that includes a lot of data that they're collecting with these athletes over a long period of time. And so this study is super, super promising because it tells us athletes can get back to sport and competitive sports safely, but it probably argues towards the inclusion of specialists in this area, at least at this time, while we're still figuring this out, to help guide that decision and counsel our patients appropriately. So super promising, and I think we'll give athletes a lot of hope as we're seeing this more and more, but there are some caveats, a pretty big caveat, in fact, there as well.
I think that's a very poignant point to make. And most of us are primary care sports medicine physicians, And it's important to have that counseling piece and talking with them, but also very important to have a multidisciplinary team to talk about all the different aspects of consideration here. Scott, thank you so much for breaking these two top articles down on platelet plasma for lateral elbow tendinopathy. And of course, this great analysis looking at those with ICDs and genetic heart disease and the potential for them and the hope for the future of successfully returning to play using shared decision-making. Thank you so much for coming on today.
Thanks a lot, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
I'd like to thank Dr. Scott Paradise from the AMSSM Top Articles Committee. Links to these articles can be found in our podcast show notes. I'd also like to thank you, the listener. I hope you have found this time valuable. And if so, please, please, please share this podcast with colleagues and help promote the visibility of the podcast by liking, subscribing, and leaving quality 5-star reviews on your preferred listening platform. We hope you'll join us for the 2024 AMSSM Annual Meeting in Baltimore, Maryland, April 12th through the 17th. Please join us again soon for the next edition of the AMSSM Sports Medcast. The views expressed are ours alone and do not represent the official policy or position of the AMSSM, the Defense Health Agency, the U.S. Navy, U.S. Army, Department of Defense, or the U.S. government.